Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm speaking with Nicholas McDowell, author of the book Poet of Revolution, The Making of John Milton. Nick, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you, Mark, and thanks for inviting me.
Well, thanks for agreeing to be on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Sure. This month I'm just celebrating 20 years of working at the University of Exeter in the southwest of England. Before that, I was a research fellow at Cambridge, and I did my doctorate at Oxford, and I was an undergraduate at Cambridge. But before all of that, I was born and grew up in Belfast in Northern Ireland and lived there in the 70s and 80s, which had a kind of profound effect on me growing up, trying to understand the nature, if you like, of internal conflict and political and religious difference. And it's very much something that has kind of shaped my scholarly interests ever since.
What was it that led you to write a biography of John Milton? Because as you explain in your introduction, there's already a number of good books on him. What led you to undertake such a, in some ways, very daunting project?
Well, that's quite true. I mean, there's a prosaic answer to that in that I was asked to do it by Princeton University Press, who approached me about writing what they called an intellectual biography of Milton. And this was in a period just after the 400th anniversary of Milton's birth in 2008. And there had actually been three biographies that year, I think, of various kind of types, some high scholarly, one a bit more popular. So I myself was slightly daunted by the prospect, given that John Milton may be, after Shakespeare, the most written about English poet. But I did feel that there were problems with all the biographical studies hitherto, certainly the 20th and 21st century biographies. And of course, research is constantly evolving. And I felt the time was right in the second decade of the 21st century for a new interpretation, particularly in this book, of how John Milton became politicized, radicalized, whatever term you might want to use, how such a on the surface conformable middle class young man ends up being the spokesman for a revolution in England in the mid 17th century, and of course then how he goes on to not only do that but to write the greatest epic poem in English, Paradise Lost.
That for me was the first revelation I had when I was reading your book, which was the notion of how our understanding of Milton is still evolving. You think on the one hand, you're talking about a person who lived four centuries ago. You would think that like so many other authors, we know everything that there is to know about him. But as you explain, we're still discovering things that we've discovered so much simply since that 400-year anniversary about him. Yeah. You mentioned in your introduction about how after you had sent the manuscript to press, there was the discovery of the of what might be Milton's copy of Shakespeare's First Folio with all of his notes in it.
Yeah, no, absolutely stunning discovery. And I mean, if anything, it was a reminder that still huge amounts of material out there, even after 400 years, that can be discovered. That was it. I mean, it was, as you say, the discovery of what appears to be Milton's copy of Shakespeare's First Folio in the fall of 2019, just as I was finishing this book and submitting it to the publisher. I did manage to refer to it a few times and in the introduction. But you're right. I mean, one of the reasons for that, and this is true of many figures in the early modern sort of pre 1800 period, is that the increase in digitization of libraries has allowed people to search for what they're looking for in ways that you know, even 20 years ago were very, very difficult and so undreamt of by even biographers at the beginning of the 21st century, really. Things are always appearing. And in the book, I do try to take account of the discovery of a number of other books and archival details about Milton. And I'm sure there'll be more will continue to be discovered. But really, some of them are quite fascinating. That the discovery of his copy of Shakespeare is obviously, a headline grabber. But the one, and we'll see what people make of that over the coming years. I'll have to take account of it myself in future work. The one I do try to make some mileage out of in my book is the discovery of Milton's copy of A Life of Dante, the great Italian Renaissance epicist, in which Milton marks up passages to do with censorship and about the way that the state treats poets with whom it disagrees or with whom it identifies as politically unorthodox. And because he was doing that in quite an early stage of his life in the 1630s, that gave me a great insight into the process, if you like, of his growing sense of the relationship between a writer and a state and a government. And the processes of censorship and persecution, and how those play out in history.
And as you make it clear in the book, that is so important to understanding Milton, because it's one of the other things that for me was really fascinating to read about in the book, which was the degree to which that he was such a deep intellect, that he was so well read in a way that you really it would not to denigrate other poets and authors, but he really does seem, as you put it, to be the most intellectual poet of English history.
Well, that's one of the other daunting things, of course. For several years, when people asked me what I was doing, and I told them I was writing a biography of Milton, and particularly of his intellectual formation, they sort of looked at me as if I, was deluded. It is true to say that he probably is the most learned of all English poets. Although, as I try to make clear in the book, I think by the severe and hugely impressive standards of Renaissance intellectuals, I think Milton himself always felt that he wasn't actually on the level of some of the great intellectual figures in the 17th century with whom he tried to become friends and whom he greatly admired. He's one of the things about Milton, which I hope comes out in the book, is that he's always thinking very hard about himself as a writer and as an individual in history. And that's an unusual self-consciousness. And I think he's always thinking about, how his place in history and literary history and political history will be seen and remembered, and what place he's making for himself. And one of the things he's worried about is that he doesn't actually have the learning and intellectual capacity that he needs to become the writer and the intellectual that he wants to become. And he always looks enviously at other intellectuals around Europe. He goes to visit Galileo, for instance. He goes to visit the great Dutch legal thinker, Hugo Grotius, in Paris. Grotius exiled from his homeland for his religious beliefs, Galileo under house arrest in Catholic Italy. So you can see already, of course, that he's interested in the relationship again between the intellectual and the state. But he dedicates much of his early life to trying to live up to an image of the intellectual, which to us seems hopelessly utopian, perhaps.
And it's so important to understanding him, as you make clear. And this gets to that question you've already mentioned, which is this notion of his political views. I mean, he's very much a person who is engaged with his time. He's not just a writer writing irrespective of what's going on, that he's a person who is very much involved in the intellectual, the spiritual, the political currents of his era. And as you explained, that's where you get to this, you know, challenge of how does that person who comes from this, you know, solid, respectable, stable, middle-class background become such a, you know, prominent and even a radical public intellectual.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that, that is one of the key kind of rationales I have for writing this book, as we mentioned a little earlier, is just to try and offer a convincing narrative of how Milton becomes politicized, and also to integrate that narrative with his poetic ambition, which is probably the one consistent thing. There are periods when he seems to leave poetry alone, usually when he's being employed as a political writer. But for the most part, his poetic ambition is the most consistent thing in his life. So the two major previous biographies of the 21st century, one came out in 2000 by the great Harvard professor Barbara Lewalsky, who sadly died a few years ago, called The Life of John Milton. And that very much presented Milton as someone who was always politically radical. So Lewalsky painted a picture of Milton whenever she could find any evidence at all for trying to argue that he was always, you know, radicalized from a very young age. That's the picture she would present the reader with. So all his early contacts and so on, Lewalsky tried to represent as stages in a radicalization that was deep and had, you know, last, you know, something that took hold even in his teenage years. And that, you know, his Puritan beliefs, and Puritan's a word we haven't mentioned yet, but it's one I spend quite a lot of time with in the book. His Puritan religious beliefs shaped his radical political beliefs, and which eventually culminated in his support of the execution of King Charles I during the English Civil Wars. Lewalsky's narrative has the virtue of being linear and comprehensible. We can see how, you know, the adult comes out of the boy. The other biography of 2008 by Gordon Campbell and Thomas Corns, John Milton, Life, Work and Thought, presented a sharply different picture. What they presented was an extremely conservative young man, conservative to the point of being anti-Puritan up until the late 1630s, who suddenly then becomes a politicized writer when the English Civil War breaks out in 1642. Milton, by 1641, Milton's already taking up his pen to write against the Church of England, and eventually goes on to defend the execution of Charles I in 1649, as I've said. So for Campbell and Corns, they felt Lewalsky had skewed the evidence completely, and there was no evidence of any sort of political radicalism up until basically the point where he lifts up his pen and starts writing prose attacks on the Church of England with the outbreak of the English Civil War. So I thought neither of these narratives will do. If you like, there has to be a more convincing historical account that can take account both of his individual personality and his great poetic ambitions, and can also take account of his relationship to the development of the political and religious context in Civil War England. And so what I tried to do is look at, particularly in the 1630s, how after he left university, he spent quite a long time in university, did an MA at Cambridge as well as a BA degree. But after he left, he dedicated himself just to reading for the next 6 years. And I tried to use archival discoveries, the evidence of his own notebooks, to show how that was a crucial period as his reading, he went through a fairly orthodox regime of reading histories about Europe, particularly. He was particularly interested in history in that period. And as he was reading these histories of Europe, the origins of the English Civil War were starting to develop. Increasingly in the 1630s, the relationship between Charles I and his parliament was becoming oppositional. Puritan religion was starting to take on a greater profile in the period. there was greater discontent with Charles I's religious policies. And so what I argue is that Milton's reading sort of starts interacting with the historical world around him. And he starts to read what's happening around him in the world in terms of that those histories of other countries, other places in Europe that have gone through political revolution or have gone through political disruption or persecution. So I try to position Milton. My Milton is neither always radical or someone who just undergoes this sudden overnight switch to being a political radical, but someone who can see intellectually his mind developing over the course of the 1630s in that crucial period that leads to the outbreak of civil war in England and also Scotland and Ireland.
There's an aspect of it that I also wanted to make clear for listeners, which is that you also describe the context in which this is taking place, that the fact that it's not happening in a static political and religious environment, that at the same time, you describe the Jacobean consensus in which Milton grew up, and then by the time you get to the 1630s, you're seeing this polarization taking place, and it's the sort of thing that's happening where people who are as intellectually and spiritually engaged as Milton are having to consider, if there's a polarization, what side is he going to take? And that dynamic plays out in your book, just as you're describing as well his intellectual evolution.
Yeah, I mean, a great example of this is his earliest tutor, who's a Scotsman called Thomas Young, who Milton's father. Now, it should be pointed out that one of the reasons that Milton could go away and read for 6 years is that his father was a very successful businessman, had made a lot of good deals, and as a result, Milton essentially didn't really need to work. And so the leisure that he had to read is an important thing to remember here. But even before he went to school in St. Paul's School in London, his father hired a tutor for him, and it was a clergyman, Scottish clergyman called Thomas Young. Now this is in Lewalski's narrative, in the narrative of Milton as a kind of always radical figure, always a developing radical. Young is presented as a Puritan who's somewhat at odds with the Church of England, who he spends some time in Europe abroad as a chaplain, and this is presented by biographers like Lewalski as evidence that he was estranged from the situation, the Church in England. This was after he tutored Milton. In fact, what we discover is, if we look at Young without any sort of preconceptions, is that Young was really a perfectly conformable clergyman. Who was employed by the Church of England. He was not a Puritan separatist in any way. He may have been closer to, he may have been what historians sometimes now call the hotter sort of Protestant, i.e. he was slightly more morally zealous than your average Church of England minister, but he certainly wasn't a separatist in any way. And indeed, he was extremely learned in Latin and classical literatures, and Milton writes a Latin poem to him to thank him for introducing him to the world of Latin poetry. What does happen, though, with someone like Thomas Young is that in the 1630s, as the situation worsens in England and Charles I and his Archbishop of Canterbury, William Laud, who becomes a central figure in the deteriorating political and religious situation in England in the 1630s and is eventually executed by Parliament in the 1640s. Charles I and William Laud push the church and the government of a religious government of England in a direction that men like Young were no longer happy with and could no longer conform to. And so Young does, in the end, by the early 1640s, become a prominent critic of the Church of England. And indeed, as I argue in the book, Milton's first anonymous piece of political prose or polemical prose was almost certainly the result of Young asking him to contribute to a pamphlet that Young himself had written with some other oppositional clerics against the Church of England in 1641. So I think that's the real benefit for me of trying to set these characters in the narrative of historical events and using the historical detail to show how, as events change, also people's ideas change. People are not static all the way through their lives. I think we can all appreciate that. We don't all have the same opinions as a teenager that we do when we're in our 30s or 40s or afterwards. And so what I tried to do in this cataclysmic historical moment of the English Civil War is to show how events do change the way people believe in political and religious ideologies.
I was wondering if you could perhaps take us back a bit to Newton's childhood. Why was it that his father was engaging tutors? Why was it that he was learning Greek and Latin? What sort of childhood did he have? What was his family aspiring for the young John Milton?
Well, I mean, he seems to have had a very happy childhood, really. His father, as I said, was a wealthy scrivener and made a lot of money. Milton had the best, but also his father clearly did believe in the power of education and did everything. And Milton writes a Latin poem to his father in which he thanks him for everything he's done for him. He acknowledges that his father was a crucial figure in his education, arranging tutors to come in to teach him languages. Milton not only was very proficient in Latin and Greek, probably even by the time before he even went to secondary school, to grammar school in London. He also knew Italian. He had some Hebrew. He became polylingual at a very early age, and he thanks his father for arranging these tutors. So I think there's nothing to suggest that Milton's father either was nothing but a very sort of contented, orthodox figure. So there's really nothing in Milton's youth to suggest the person that he would become. I think as he points out in his own poem to his father was a musician as well as being a businessman. He was a musician of some accomplishment. And Milton, in this lovely poem to his father, thanks his father and sees himself as a kind of Orpheus figure, the great classical poet. Who's, his father accompanying him on the lyre. So already, even though he hasn't written very many poems at this point, he's thinking of himself as the great poet, but he remembers his father as accompanying him with musical accompaniment. And he thinks of them both together involved in the creation of poetry. So yeah, it was, it was a very happy childhood, it would appear.
Was he always aspiring to be a poet, or was there another career path in mind for him as he was being tutored and then as he goes off to university?
Well, I've just said that we change over time and our opinions change in relation to events around us. And I think that's entirely true. But one thing that really marks Milton out as unusual, I think, even amongst Renaissance poets, is this degree of self-consciousness that he does seem to have from quite an early age about his poetic ambition. It probably becomes most prevalent when he goes to university. He goes to Christ's College in Cambridge, and I spent quite a lot of time in the book reconstructing the curriculum there and the kind of figures he would have known. Because it's this point at university when he has a real opportunity to display his learning, his facility in Latin in particular. His Latin poems are not the finest, they're not the greatest Latin poems of the period written by university students, but they attracted attention from fellow students, and he became known as an accomplished writer. And in those early university student poems, already you can see very much the sense that he has an image that he wants to aspire to of the great epic poet. And I think that is one thing about Milton that does persist, at least up until the point where he becomes time political civil writer and civil servant in the 1650s, and we might come back to that. An unusual degree of self-consciousness, shaped shaped by movements in Europe, the humanist movement that puts so much emphasis on education in languages and rhetoric and poetics. Milton, if you like, is one of its last great flowerings of the humanist emphasis on language and poetry as the characteristic of a virtuous person, the mastery of languages and poetics as the characteristic of a virtuous person. So I think, his fellow students, famously, some listeners may be aware of this, he was sometimes known as the Lady of Christ's College by his student, by other students in the college. And this has always been thought, you know, it must kind of signal some kind of perceived effeminacy, or, you know, people were mocking him. But actually, as I suggest in the book, it seems, in fact, to be modeled on Virgil, the great Latin epic writer. Virgil, in biographies of Virgil, which circulated in the period in which, you know, Milton was growing up, Virgil was represented as very much a kind of virginal figure, sometimes known as the maiden. You know, he was very, very abstemious from kind of sensual pleasures. And it appears that Milton, in his desire to become an English Virgil, sort of modeled himself on the maidenish or a figure of Virgil. And that's where the Lady of Christ's nickname seems to come from, not necessarily from some kind of mockery by his fellow students, but a recognition that, you know, this is someone who wanted from the age of a student to become the great English poet.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I was really thought was fascinating in your book, because I mean, I think of Milton as a 17th century figure, and yet it was really interesting the way that you present him as this, as you pointed out, this late Renaissance figure. And I was thinking that comes across not just when you're talking about his education, his intellectual development at that stage in his life, but also the tour that he undertakes, in particular to Italy, which I thought was really fascinating, because you think of, on the one hand, given his, revulsion may be a little too strong of a word, but given his opposition to Catholicism, you wouldn't think of him as going to the very heart of Catholicism to interact with people and to discover and to learn. And yet he does that. And as you make it clear, it's part of that sense of himself as, as a Renaissance humanist, that he is a person who, embraces that tradition in terms of his learning of classical languages and in terms of his embrace of the literature of the era.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, it's funny, he looks back on, when he's writing, he has a number of sort of biographical accounts of himself that he gives throughout his life. And this is one of the challenges for a biographer, of course, because Milton sort of tries to write his own life for you. And so the challenge for the biographer is not to fall too much into that kind of trap of believing everything Milton tells you about himself, and it's seductive in many ways, and I hope I've avoided it in the book. But when he looks back on that trip to Italy, which he took in 1638 to 1639, he sort of left England just as England was, the whole of the British Isles was becoming increasingly starting to break down in terms of political and religious authority. And civil wars would break out in 1642, but there were already battles going on in Scotland by 1640. He goes away and does this tour of Italy, and certainly, it was fairly traditional for well-off young gentlemen to go on a tour of Italy tours of Europe as he does, and it makes a lot of sense, of course, to visit Rome. To visit Florence, the seat of Renaissance humanism. But funnily enough, when he looks back on his time in Italy in the 1650s, he writes, what he's most concerned with is defending himself against, he says, I went through Italy, but I avoided the seductions and temptations of Catholicism. Even though they tried to tempt me into their religion, I remained firm. And there's a kind of hint that also, there are kind of sexual temptations, which he also remained firm against. But actually, the way that he seems to have experienced the trip when it actually happened was that he absolutely loved it. He was invited. He was invited into quite senior Catholic circles in places in Italy. Had great intellectual conversations with Italians, and the religious confessional differences between them did not seem to be a real issue in the late 1630s. And I think you're right, it's very much, there's a sense in some ways that the pursuit of learning is something that it should be supra-confessional, if you like, it should be above religious difference. There's no animus against individual Catholics, certainly, it's more his sense of Catholicism as a form of authority, a form of religion which he feels suppresses wit and learning. And so, you know, I think we can differentiate between his attitude towards Catholicism as a concept, if you like, or, you know, Roman Catholicism as a what he regarded as a persecutory type of religious government, and his evident enjoyment and relish in exchanging intellectual, exchanging knowledge and ideas with Italian Catholics.
I'd like to take us back a bit to his time at Christ College, and then afterward when he's undergoing that period of self-development. What is he doing in terms of his writing to develop as a poet? What is he working on during this period? And what does this say about his intellectual development during this time?
Yeah, well, I very much see his time at university as a time of experimentation with different genres. So perhaps unusually, I'm often an obvious admiration of Milton's intellectual achievements, but I'm quite clear-eyed about his university poetry, not all of which, you know, we read it today because it's Milton's, but, you know, in itself, some of it is not the most constant or accomplished poetry that one could find, whether in English or Latin. And then he also wrote in Italian as well. So when he leaves university, he's actually, although it's hard for us to recover this, he's actually not particularly, he's got a small reputation as a poet when he leaves university. He's by no, and compared to some of his contemporaries, he's by no means applauded. There are other contemporaries who I talk about in the book, minor poets like Thomas Randolph, who are now more or less forgotten, who died an early death, who was far more praised at college and at Cambridge than Milton was as a poet. There are others who some people might have heard of, like Richard Crashaw, who became a well-known religious poet and eventually converted to Catholicism, actually, in the 1640s, much, much more successful as a university poet than Milton. So when he left, having, you know, a smallish body of work, some great poems that we still read on the morning of Christ's nativity, one of his early devotional poems is still a poem that is much read today and much commented on, and is an example of his early talents. But he hadn't really done very much. You know, he left 1632, he left Cambridge. He's already well into his, you know, mid, going into his late 20s. He really hasn't done very much. And then, of course, he goes away and writes for another 6 years. Now, he has a letter in 1633 that he writes to a friend. We don't know who the friend is, although I suggest it was Thomas Young, his old tutor in my book, in which he you know, lays bare his sense of inadequacy, that he hasn't achieved anything as yet. But at the same time, he doesn't want to go into the church, which is the obvious career route for him. Most of the people he was at university with became clergymen. And that was the obvious route for him. And he says he doesn't want to follow that route. And he sets himself out as someone who's going to continue to pursue poetry rather than take the obvious and easier career route into the church. And so he sets about, at that point, sets himself this reading course, which I mentioned earlier, very intensive reading course, mainly in history, but in other areas as well. We're very fortunate to have one of his so-called commonplace books, which is essentially a notebook of his reading. One of those commonplace books survives. And so we can trace quite a lot of his reading, certainly from the mid-1630s onwards. But he also, I suggest in the book at this point, he's considering the possibility of being a kind of professional poet, possibly even a playwright. His first major commission as a writer is a work that some people may know called... known as Comus today after its kind of lead demonic character, but it was originally known as a mask performed at Ludlow Castle. And this was a kind of aristocratic commission that he was hired to do for the installation of the Earl of Bridgewater on the border with Wales. And he wrote what was known in the period as a mask, which is kind of a theatrical performance involving music, song and dance. Milton's version of a mask has a lot more dialogue in it, and it takes on some serious issues to do with chastity, sexual temptation, the proper way for an individual to behave when faced with temptation, which are themes, of course, that you can trace right through Milton's career, right up into Paradise Lost. And but that's about it. That's about it, really, at this point. You know, he doesn't, that commission doesn't really seem to lead to anything else. People seem to like it, but there's not a lot of evidence of how people reacted to it in the period. And so he really goes back again after that early kind of experiment with drama. He goes back again into his reading and doesn't really write much poetry up until the later 1630s.
You mentioned that he, over this period, he has this project gestating in his mind, this notion of this epic history of Britain. And you, as you describe, so much of his reading is focused upon this, and how it's from what he's gaining from this that you start to see him developing some of the arguments and some of the materials that he's going to use once he becomes a polemicist in the 1640s.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, he himself, I mean, what we can tell from his, there's another notebook of his poetic projects, which is now in Trinity College, Cambridge, which we also have, probably the most important kind of literary manuscript in English. And in that, he outlines in the late 1630s, probably, his idea that if he's going to write an epic poem, it's going to be on the Arthurian legends, King Arthur and so on. And really, he does talk about writing about the fall, Adam and Eve and the fall, and original sin, but in the form of a tragic drama. He does, the title Paradise Lost does appear there, but in the form of a tragic drama rather than a poem. So his epic poem is going to be based on mythical English history. And that's his idea, it would appear, right up into the early 1640s of what he's going to do. But alongside this, he's reading intensively, as I said, in other types of history. And in his notes, his commonplace book of that reading is divided up into different topics. And some of those topics include, you know, censorship, tyranny, kingship, the free circulation of books, some of the major topics of his prose in the 1640s, particularly. So you can start to see, in a way, he's reading, his course of reading is quite orthodox. The authors he's reading are the kind of authors that any well-educated gentleman might read in the period. But what he actually is doing with the notes, and this is where it's very, again, there's the seduction of always reading backwards from the political radical back into his youth. But it certainly does seem to be the case, and I do maintain this in the book, that you can see in the kind of notes that he's making, that even if he hasn't really formed a kind of politically oppositional mind at this point, you can see that the notes that he's making offer him a kind of armory or arsenal of ideas that he could then call upon, as you know, British history did turn towards conflict and war. So I see that period, which, you know, poetically can look a little blank. I actually see it intellectually as absolutely crucial, that period of the mid to late 1630s.
You mentioned how, you've already mentioned how Young reaches out to him and solicits material that appears in a pamphlet that, in effect, opens the way to Milton becoming a polemicist. Why was it that Milton chose to become a polemicist? Because as you described up to this point, he's very much focused on what we might think of as inward development and on improving himself upon that intellectual exploration. And yet you have here his first sustained external engagement where he's really trying to go out and put his ideas out there. What was it that led him to make that leap, and what does he produce during this period?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. I mean, that's a crucial moment for me. I mean, you know, clearly there is a big difference between sitting in your, you know, comfortable study reading about political history and thinking, well, how this might be relevant to the situation taking place around you. There's a big difference then to moving from that to actually writing political and polemical prose, which he starts doing in 1641. As the situation really becomes deteriorates quite markedly, and the kind of sources of authority collapse. You know, the Church of England basically dissolves, the court collapses, the king flees, a civil war breaks out. So no, that's a very good question. I suggest that there's not just one simple reason for that shift, but a whole series of them. One, I think, is his growing sense that England was, and this is where Catholicism is relevant, I think. I think there was a growing sense, one of the reasons the war breaks out is a growing sense amongst the hotter sort of Protestants in England, that England under Charles I and Archbishop Laud is drifting back towards Catholicism. Now, for Milton, this means from his reading about European and history and Italian history, this means to him a kind of a withdrawal back into a kind of closed, narrow intellectual sphere. So his reading about, for instance, I mentioned earlier about Dante and how, you know, Dante had been censored by the Catholic Church. He also, you know, Galileo, who he goes to meet in Italy in his grand tour, who was he'd been put under house arrest for his ideas by the Church. And increasingly, you can see in his, I think one of the reasons intellectually why he shifts to an active polemical position is that he is increasingly anxious about the idea that England will drift into the kind of persecutory, tyrannous regime that he identifies with counter-reformation countries, Catholic countries in Europe around him. So that's one reason, I think. I think also that Thomas Young was still quite an influence on him. He could see that men whom he respected, like Young, a very learned figure who had taught him from an early age, he could see that people like Young were now becoming oppositional and actually taking up their pens to write against the Church of England and eventually the King. I think that also persuaded him, and I think he was still in dialogue with Young. And certainly his first, as I say, his first anonymous prose work is part of one of Young's own writings. There may all be other personal issues as well. There's some evidence, and this again is another piece of archival evidence that is comparatively recent, that there was a visitation of by one of the kind of the ecclesiastical hierarchy under the Laudian Church, Archbishop Laud's church, to the church in which his mother was buried. His mother had died in the 1630s. And that they demanded that his mother's grave was they said that his mother's grave was facing the wrong way, needed to be turned around, and that the pew of the Milton family was too high up and needed to be lowered within the church. Sounds like quite petty stuff to us, perhaps, and quite petty details, but these things mattered in 1630s England. And so the Milton family had their own close encounter with the kind of interfering persecutory aspects of the church that was being established under Charles I and Laud, his archbishop. So I think there's a kind of bundle of things. There are things in the book I talk about. I think there's a bundle of things that come together to turn him into someone who actively takes up the pen against the status quo in England.
So what does he argue in his works? Is he arguing for, the execution of the king? Is he, at this point, or is he more religiously focused? Is he, do you see an evolution in his position during this period, or does he pretty much stake out a point that he holds pretty consistently to through all five of the polemics that he writes?
No, well, certainly, so his early, the early religious works, 1641, 1642, are very much focused on the Church of England, and they attack the whole hierarchy of bishops in the Church of England, and they're very much focused on that. They're also, of course, some of these pamphlets have remarkable digressions in which Milton just goes off tangent and starts talking about his own poetic ambitions and what he thinks, tragedy should really be like, what an epic poem should be like, and he's just going, readers thought of these when they bought a pamphlet that seemed to be about, the situation in the Church of England and how it had to be reformed, and got instead Milton talking for many pages about what his own poetic ambitions and how he was going to write a great epic poem and what the rules of an epic should be. It's hard to know what the reaction was. People must have been rather perplexed by this. But he did write, five pamphlets altogether in that brief flurry of his first political, the first flurry of his political life. But no, things do change. I mean, this is, again, like I've stressed with the earlier part of the book, the evolution of his ideas in relation to historical events is absolutely crucial. So there's no suggestion in those early pamphlets that, you know, he's interested in overthrowing the king. That would have been a very radical position to take in the early 1640s, and virtually no one took it. But what you do see, and I think a big crucial moment, and this is where the first part of my biography more or less finishes, a crucial moment for Milton is he gets married in 1642. Now, this is a rather surprising event in itself, but he is getting into his late 30s at this point, or his mid-30s. He gets married in 1642, and as some listeners may know, famously, his wife left him after only a few weeks of marriage. And people were very surprised that he got married in the first place. Nobody was prepared for it. His wife left him after only a few weeks, and he set about writing a number of pamphlets in favor of divorce on the grounds of incompatibility between husband and wife. Up to that point, divorce was really on the grounds of adultery. It was kind of sexually defined. Divorce was the only way, that was the only way divorce could take place. Milton, in what seems to us as a kind of far-sighted position, argued that if the married couple didn't get on with each other anymore, if they found they were not compatible, then they should be allowed to divorce. And this is really a very surprising thing for him to do. You know, there's very little to prepare for this. Although he does, again, if you go back to his notes from the 1630s, divorce is one of the topics in which he's more interested in. So again, you know, he's been reading about divorce, and he has a kind of litany of quotations and sources that he can cite when he comes to defend his position on divorce. But really, it's quite unexpected, this shift. And so I think this is where maybe the personal and the political combine. What Milton was astonished by was the reaction to his arguments on divorce. He was absolutely pilloried for them by both sides, by the Puritans and the Parliamentarians on the one side, and by, you know, the Church of England figures against whom he'd been writing earlier. And this leads to a real disillusionment on his part with people, indeed, including Thomas Young, his great sort of mentor earlier in his career, who are part of the Puritan opposition. He becomes essentially an anti-clerical at this point, and, you know, has no time for either side in the kind of religious debates of the 1640s. And I think this is the point, and he goes on then to write Areopagitica, his great argument for the free circulation of ideas in print. And he's prompted into doing that by the reaction to his own pamphlets on divorce. People in Parliament were calling for them to be burnt, for him to be himself, brought before Parliament and prosecuted for publishing those tracts. So Areopagitica, which is, one of the great works in the Western liberal tradition in favour of free speech and the kind of marketplace of ideas, comes directly out of that kind of that clash between the personal and the political experiences through the divorce tracts.
Well, I apologize if you're getting a little tired of this question, but how's Volume 2 coming along?
Right, yes. Yeah, so, it should be clear that this Poet of Revolution takes us to the first half of Milton's life from 1608 to 1642. And I leave just at the point, I stop just at the point where he gets married. So that bit about just been talking about the divorce tracts is to come at the beginning of the second volume, which will take us right through to his death in 1674, and obviously encompass the thing, I guess, for which Milton, of course, is best known, which is his poem Paradise Lost. So Volume 2 is about a third to just over a third already written, and I'm hoping to submit it to Princeton University Press in 2022, end of 2022. Beginning of 2023 at the latest. So hopefully it'll be out 2023 to 2024. And of course, it presents its own challenges. I want to continue that sense of a narrative of an evolving personality in relation to events. His life only gets more tumultuous as he, you know, in 1649, as I mentioned earlier, he defends the execution of Charles I, one of the first people to do this. He offers perhaps the most radical defense of anyone. And then he gets employed by the Republican government and by Oliver Cromwell in the 1650s to be a kind of propagandist and civil servant, and works for the Republican regimes right through the 1650s until in 1660 the monarchy is restored and Milton is at risk of his life and only just about escapes with his life. He's in prison for a while. And at that point, he turns to finishing Paradise Lost, which is a very different poem than the Arthurian epic that he first envisaged writing.
Well, don't let me keep you from writing a second longer than I have, because I'm really looking forward to reading it. Nicholas McDowell, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you.